currently 33 degrees in Kalamazoo. And it's occurring to me right now that my guest here this morning may not appreciate these Fahrenheit temperature numbers, because Colin Currie, you are
more of a centigrade guy.
Yeah, more of a centigrade kind of person. I have a world renowned musician here in the studio who will be joining Jack Quartet in concert tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall at Western Michigan University. Colin Currie is a percussionist who has made new inroads in modern music with a variety of percussion instruments. Colin, welcome to WMUK.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
I'm glad you came a day. Often, a lot of artists just, you know, cut that difference down to like a few hours before.
Don't we just?
Yeah. But it's great to have a chance to get to know you a little bit here this morning before you perform tonight with Jack Quartet. And a special treat for listeners, I did call up one of the members of Jack Quartet. And, you know, I didn't ask him too many questions about you or your behind the scenes habits or anything, but he also, John Richards, will talk a little about the program as well. And we'll both get to listen to that again. But I'd like to maybe start off, Colin, with this extraordinary career of yours. Was it very intentional to, you know, take your skills as a percussionist and get them out in front of even more kinds of people and with more kinds of music than had been common before?
Well, I was driven particularly by the latter motivation, musically speaking, to push the repertoire. I think I sort of came alive as a musician in the mid-90s, maybe the first half of the 90s, thanks to two wonderful teachers I had, not only a percussion teacher, Pamela Dow, but my piano teacher, Sheila Dessen, back in Scotland.
Which is a percussion instrument.
Yeah, it's very true, although it's a very different kind of set of skills. But they really sort of just woke me up in so many different ways. And then I think particularly studying the piano and the repertoire that was available to the pianist just seems like this extraordinary, colossal canon of music, stretching back and also going forward. And I felt that it was so exciting to have pieces of such depth and beauty and quality, but I didn't really see so many of those kinds of things on the percussion instruments. There have been amazing developments for percussion, and wonderful composers have written for us, but as a soloist, as a solo musician, it was still only really kind of starting at that time. So I had this resolve very early on to try and see if I could somehow harness or create or be part of that development, because I knew what music could do, and I felt that percussion repertoire hadn't quite hit that mark yet, but that it could, and then it definitely ought to. And so I just set about trying to improve as a player, and then you're sort of laying the tracks down in front of you. I mean, I had no idea I could actually become full-time soloist, chamber musician. But you just do what you can and work as the pieces come along. You make sure that they're good and that they sound right, and try and piece things together. And that's what's happened to me. I mean, you know, I've been playing as a soloist now for over a quarter of a century.
Percussion is a term for a group of instruments, a seemingly endlessly growing group of instruments. What was your focus specifically? Can you name the five or six different things you are specialized in?
Rightly, as a solo percussionist, you have a strong relationship with the keyboard instruments. So particularly the marimba, because it's such a rich sound and appealing sound, and also the register is large. It's as well as being an instrument that was initially in the treble clef and extending somewhat down into the bass clef. It's now an instrument that's five octaves and goes right the way down to the low C, which is the same low C that you have on, for example, the cello. So it's right down off the bass clef down to the low C. So it's a beautiful instrument with many, many possibilities, coloristic possibilities, harmonic possibilities. You can play chords with selection of mallets, up to four mallets or even more mallets these days at any one time. So many, many possibilities. But there are other tuned instruments as well, such as the vibraphone, of course, which I'll be playing tonight quite widely. And then other, you know, I mean, too many other instruments to name. But there's the multiple percussion setup pieces, one of which I'll be playing tonight, the Yannis Xenakis work, which is perhaps the most famous of all of them, the Rebond B. So it, just getting a good grasp on all of this and turning it into music is the key always.
Well, it just strikes me that these different instruments require such different techniques that it's like mastering a completely different. A violinist focuses on violin, but a percussionist, you need to get that mallet work mastered on.
Yeah,
different sizes of keyboards, or you know,
very much so. And also, each new piece has a new setup.
Yeah.
So, especially the concertos, most of them have quite a lot of instruments, and often they're integrated. And you have to first of all, you design your instrument, so you sort of decide how it's going to. Like the Andrew Norman concerto might be a good example, where there are many instruments to cover in a short space of time. You whiz around these things back and forth throughout the whole piece, and you need them close, you need them to hand, and it's really I had to learn it from the ground up, design the setup, learn to get around it, and as I keep saying, you know, make something of it. It's not just getting around the notes, but turning it into phrases and musical information and something that's graspable and enjoyable and delightful to hear. So that's the challenge. I think it's making everything cohesive and strong.
Have you been in a position several times or more to kind of assist the composer in designing that setup?
Yeah, I mean, the great gaggle of composers that I've worked with, first of all, they've all been wonderful, and they've all had the challenge of writing for percussion, and they've approached it different ways. Some with great facility, and others needing more assistance and encouragement and input. So a huge variety of needs. But of course, yeah, I have been, in certain pieces, I've been very close with composers, you know, teaching them sticking patterns, rhythms, opening them up to little tricks of the trade that might work and how to get things to sound a certain way. And others just sort of vanish without trace, and then a full score arrives on your doormat, you know, a year or two later.
My guest is Colin Curry, who is a pioneering modern percussionist who has collaborated with so many different kinds of ensembles that if you can think of it, it may have happened. Colin will be with the Jack Quartet tonight at 7:30 at the Dalton Center Recital Hall here on Western's campus with a program of three works, some of them so new that the pieces arrived, you know, in your inbox within the last month or less. And
yes, let's leave it there, shall we?
Yeah. But a piece by a very good friend, so as well, a piece that, I talked to John Richards, who's the violist and founding member, one of the founding members of Jack Quartet, and he said one of the pieces was premiered, and it also happens to be where Jack Quartet and yourself, Colin, had your first collaboration.
That's right. Yeah.
So maybe I'll let John do the talking for a little bit here, and we'll listen to what he has to say about tonight's program.
Lovely, yeah.
And then we'll be back with Colin Curry. You'll hear me asking John a question about the time you met to get us started. John, can you tell me how long your association, the group's association, has been with Colin Curry, percussionist?
Yeah, you know, the event that brought us together was actually quite fancy in my eyes. It was for the BBC Proms in London.
I'm going to agree with you because that's about the fanciest of the fancy.
Yeah, we were extremely excited to play for the proms, but then also to work with Colin. And for the occasion, we actually commissioned two works for the five of us, because there's actually not that much music for percussion and string quartet. And in Kalamazoo, we're going to play one of those two pieces.
let's go back a little bit, and you can tell our audience about how Jack Quartet and new music have come to be quite synonymous as your cutting-edge ensemble.
Yeah, you know, Jack Quartet formed initially while we were students at the Eastman School of Music, and while we were there, we were just completely obsessed with playing works by living composers, and it's to the point where we never even discussed that that's what we would do as a quartet. It's just what we did as a quartet. And then leaving school and growing up, we just kept doing it, and one thing led to another. It's very natural, actually.
I think of Jack Quartet as being a New York quartet as well.
That's right. We have all been living in New York for a long time now, though in the beginning we were sort of spread all over the country. We tried to maintain a New York identity because that's where the critical mass of composers seems to be.
Mm-hmm. That's where I should bring up Alarm Wheel Sound, which is sort of a bigger and more amorphous group, but has been in the thick of it with new music for many years. And you also were a founding member of Alarm Wheel Sound.
That's right. Jack Quartet sort of grew up in the wake of Alarm Wheel Sound getting started. It also came from the Eastman School of Music, and the quartet, learned so much from that organization about how to work with composers and commission and be sustainable, and eventually had to leave the ensemble because Jack needed to rehearse more, basically. And but I really admire that group. They've done so much.
Yes, yes, they have. And every concert, it's much like Jack Quartet, you get a new face, a new flavor. It's the wonderful thing about new music. You just don't know anytime you show up for a concert what kind of sounds you'll be hearing.
Yeah, it's a bit of a roulette that way.
What are your thoughts on the three pieces that you've programmed for Friday night's concert?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts, actually. We're going to be playing a piece by our friend Andy Akiho, and it's very, very fresh. Initially, we were going to commission a string quartet from him for Jack, and then this project came along, and it seemed like a perfect match, and so we kind of just adjusted it a little bit, and we actually just got the score about a week ago, and it's surprisingly very comfortable and natural to play. Maybe it's because we know him and his work, but it's really fun, and I can't wait to play it. It's called Illuminous, and it's just like a single movement work. It's great.
That's followed by Suzanne Farron's Hyper C.
That's right, which is one of the pieces that was for the original project we had with Colin for the proms. Suzanne Farron also lives in New York and is a friend of ours. And it's a completely different sound world than Andy's piece. It's very fluid, and it's all about sort of the transitions between different sounds.
And the final work on the program is by Xenakis, who I have heard of before. He's what I'd consider a pioneer in new sounds.
He is, yeah. He's like relatively a household name in strange avant-garde experimental music. you know, the piece we're playing, which is titled Tetras, was actually the first work that Jack Quartet ever performed together 15 years ago. And it's remained our favorite piece to play. It's exciting and virtuosic, and it's fun to listen to and fun to play. And what I think is so cool about it is that it draws from very sort of intellectual and mathematical ideas that create something that's actually very tangible and visceral to listen to.
And fun to play?
Totally fun.
Do any of these pieces call on the group to go outside of regular performance practice, like do anything to or on their instruments that you wouldn't find in Beethoven or Brahms?
Yes. I mean, almost everything I feel Jack Quartet plays does draw from unusual sounds. In this concert in Tetras, there's a large amount of unusual sounds, maybe sort of crunching on the strings or like tons of glissandos all the way up and down the instrument. Playing on like different unusual parts of the string behind the bridge or on the tailpiece. It's just all over the place. And something always happens. You know, someone's string will slip or break or drop, and we always just sort of have to keep going.
Do you think someday there will be like the John Richards move where, you know, a composer demands something on the page and you just have to make up a maneuver?
Oh, my goodness. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm doing that all the time, but it's within an acceptable collaborative vibe.
Well, I look forward to asking Colin about what he has to accomplish during these pieces. And I'll say to you, John, thank you very much for chatting with me today. And please enjoy your time in Kalamazoo. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, us too. Thank you so much.
I spoke with John Richards yesterday afternoon. He's violist of Jack Quartet, and now we're here live in the studio with Colin Curry, the groundbreaking percussionist who is with Jack tonight. And I think we just left off talking about this piece by Xenakis.
Yeah.
Maybe we can focus a little on the requirements of this piece and what it's going to sound and almost look like.
Sure.
Stage.
Well, we're presenting two works by Xenakis tonight, and a wonderful explanation of Tetris there by John. My role is to start the concert with Rebond B, which is extremely alluring, very attractive piece. Again, as John says, born of mathematical ideals and algorithms, and the structure is very precisely ordained, if you like, but the music ultimately bursts through these set of rigid ideals, forms, if you like, and it's just a wonderful sort of ritual for a solo percussionist. It's a drum setup that is then peppered with a similar number of wood blocks, and they go back and forth. So there's a very insistent ostinato in the drums, where a kind of melody is also laid out in the lower pitch drums over an ostinato in the higher pitch drum, the bongos. And then the woodblocks cut in and interrupt matters and create maybe a sort of question mark in the structure. Then we return to the drums, which are obviously a little bit disturbed by what's just happened. And then ultimately the music gets smashed together and items from all different parts of the structure get overlaid and pitted against each other, and it ends in a kind of stalemate between the two sonorities of the drums and the woods. I mean, it's absolute masterpiece. Not easy. It's virtuosic. It's very risky to play. You could easily trip yourself up. It's all a question of, it has to be quick. You know, it should be a fairly fast-paced kind of feel to the piece, but you daren't just push it over the edge because the whole thing could collapse. But it's a wonderful, wonderful sort of should be a kind of a breathtaking piece to listen to.
Even if you're not mathematically alert, aware, understanding of like numbers and relationships in the moment.
No.
Do you think it informs the piece? Do you think that some of the strength of his writing is somehow expressed, whether you understand the relationships or not?
For sure. I mean, I always say, with music, actually understanding it is one of the last things to be important, because music works on an intuitive level and it speaks to the emotions. So these mathematical ideas, whether it's Bach or Bartok or Xenakis, they're there, but you don't have to understand them. But in a way, you're tricked, because you do understand them simply by listening to them. You're reacting to them, and your brain is making sense of them. So in a sense, the understanding is taken care of for you. I mean, you could go into you could spend your life analyzing and reanalyzing all of these works and gaining a further understanding, or your own subjective understanding of any of these pieces that have a strong mathematical element. But the beauty is, it's not essential to understand it. And of course, in the moment, one maybe wouldn't. So if you're coming to the concert tonight and hearing these Xenakis works for the first time, you know, if we're playing them well, which I can certainly vouch that Jack are absolutely sensational in this performance of Xenakis. I actually sneaked in the back of the hall in New York and heard them do it a few days ago. I mean, it's absolutely essential listening, a real treat. Then you get carried along in the sheer audacity of the thing. I mean, it's so wildly it's entertaining and uplifting and thought provoking and weird and fun and odd and bizarre and lots of things that you might wish for in an artistic experience. But it's a very, very, I'm very fascinated by this thing about understanding music. I mean, I would say the more I play music, the less and less I understand about it. I find it very hard to talk about music. It speaks for itself so clearly. That music's always best heard live. So I hope that we're garnering some interest in our concert tonight, because these pieces in the flesh do, you know, turn your head the other way.
Visit fontanamusic.org for information on tickets. The concert starts at 7:30 tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. And I do have another clue as to why you're here a day early, because you have a lot to set up on that stage.
Yeah, need to get in there,
yeah,
get organized.
Well, let's let some music do the talking now. And maybe we will take a look at one of your newest projects, and it's a new recording with the Boston Modern Orchestra Project.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that a little?
With pleasure. Well, this has been a fantastic realization of a work that I'm deeply fond of. One of my earliest sort of breakthrough percussion concertos, written for me by Steve Mackey, who is
American
composer, you know, sounds as such. He's got that wonderful American palette, terrific orchestration, very colorful. But he's a wonderful, beautiful composer of contrasts, because he's this Princeton professor of music, and yet at the same time he's a total rocker. You know, he plays electric guitar and improviser, but then he's got all this sort of finesse to his music as well. So, and everything gets smashed together, and out comes this really, really, especially in this work, time release, very, very sophisticated, but very gentle and persuasive and soft and lovely and kind of endearing kind of sound. And time release was premiered in 2005, and I played it widely. I've played it all around the world. I've played it in some big venues like Carnegie Hall. And the opportunity arose for a Steve Mackey disc, which the Boston, yeah, it's hard to say,
it
isn't
is hard.
It? Blah, blah, blah. BMOP, there you go. Yeah. The Boston Modern Orchestra Project put together, as they do with it repeatedly, with wonderful, mostly composer-themed,
yes,
recordings. Yeah. So this was a terrific chance to record, because I love to record, to put this piece down and share it on this medium. And it's turned out beautifully. I'm absolutely delighted with how it sounds.
I'm feeling very lucky too, because I can hear all the tracks right at your website, colincurry.com.
That's it.
There's a link right there to stream the album. And you selected the second movement of this concerto by,
yeah,
Stephen Mackey.
Yeah, the second concerto is a bit more of a kind of a, after the first movement, which is fairly kind of rolling, and more of a gentle unfurling of the music. The second one is a little more of a bumpy ride, a bit more dancey, and a bit more up tempo. And also, I think you'll hear also just really sweet, just really just sort of dead, drop dead gorgeous.
Okay, I'm with Colin Curry, and we'll listen to this new concerto, newly recorded. Did you say it was released just this,
yeah,
month?
Yeah, we recorded it just almost exactly a year ago. And the release date was the 19th of November this year. So this is
brand
hot
new,
off the press.
Well, Thanksgiving is next week, but I am feeling thankful for hearing a brand new piece to me by Steve Mackey and being in the studio with the soloist, the percussionist Colin Curry. It's a brand new album we were just talking about. It was recorded a year ago, just released as a recording with the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. Colin, you're right, words are hard to use to...
Yeah. Well, a lot happens in that one movement, and that's just one of four movements in this gorgeous piece. Yeah, I'm so happy. Thank you for sharing that on your station this morning. I'm very, very delighted that we can put the word out there and the music out there for this piece.
There's three more movements, and they're all accessible through colincurry.com. And during the music, you mentioned that you're in a position to run your own recording label at this point.
Yes. Well, that's... another part of what I do is to try and leave a legacy of percussion music as I go around and have these wonderful opportunities to work with so many composers. One of my closest relationships is with Steve Reich, who's the sort of overarching, overseeing musical voice of so much of what has happened in this country. And such a venerable gentleman now, and an incredible breadth and wealth of pieces, so much so that I founded an ensemble devoted entirely to his music, and that's the Colin Curry Group, and we debuted in 2006. Now, we've had lots of chances to work with the composer since then, and he's written and dedicated a work for us, Quartet, for example, but the work that we originally played of his that really brought us close together for the first time was Drumming. And the time sort of came where we decided, well, we really have to record this now. I mean, we've learnt it. We've got our own method with it. It's interesting. It's a bit different. It's quite unlike other versions of the work. So let's record it. So we went through this whole process of crowdfunding online, and then we didn't really have a home for the recording, and that was when we had a meeting with the London Symphony Orchestra, who have their own label called LSO Live, which you might be familiar with, and they do fantastic. They have a huge catalogue of recordings, mostly from concerts that they give at the Barbican in London. But they've been working for some other people as well, including Gergiev, Valery Gergiev, the Marinsky, and also King's College Choir, and setting up record labels for those people. And just recently, actually, they've started working for the National Symphony Orchestra of Washington, D.C. So they are doing that job for people. And they gifted me my own record label, which is a nice, nice little number. So Colin Curry Records was born. And our first album was Drumming, Steve Reich Drumming. The second album was a recital disc with myself and my duo partner, Håkan Hardenberger, Swedish trumpet soloist.
Yeah.
Called The Scene of the Crime. And then the third album was our most recent one, which is the group, Colin Curry Group, live in Paris at Fondation Louis Vuitton with Steve Reich. And that album is the third in our catalogue. The next two albums are planned. So it's very exciting. And I'm very grateful to the London Symphony Orchestra for the platform that we have, because it's widely available through all the kind of channels that anyone might obtain their music. And they do a fantastic job for us, and I'm really enjoying that collaboration.
I need to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Colin Curry, one of the world's foremost modern percussionists, and he's in town to perform with Jack Quartet tonight. And they also are widely praised as groundbreaking musicians in modern music. The thing about modern music, as we just heard, there's so much of it. There's so many flavors. There's so many composers that if you have preconceived notions about new music, come down and break them at 7:30 tonight at the Dalton Center Recital Hall at Western Michigan University. Your collaboration with Jack Quartet goes back to a concert with the BBC Proms in which you premiered a piece, and you're premiering a piece tonight, I guess, almost?
Very much so.
Absolutely.
No, of course. It's the brand new piece by Andy Akiho. Andy is, again, I mean, the words for him are hard to find. I mean, so special composer, unique voice, intricate, passionate, highly cultivated, but yet with this incredibly deep sort of emotional impact from his music. This piece is not over long, the one we're premiering tonight. It's sort of 10 minutes. But I think you feel like you've just heard a symphony. It's for vibraphone and quartet, but the vibraphone is played in a certain way with the pedal permanently down, so everything rings, everything's extremely resonant. But I use these very ticky sticks, so not your normal vibraphone mallets. So if you think of a vibraphone, you would think of a length of rattan with a mallet head on it.
I think of Milt Jackson.
Good choice. Yeah, exactly. Think of Milt there with his mallet. So there's nothing like that. They're for all the world, they're just sort of like timbale sticks, which are just the dowels, just long, thin pieces of wood. And we play the vibraphone with that. And so it's resonant, but it's also very kind of, it's got this sort of texture of gentle articulation. And it's perfectly orchestrated with the strings, who fit with it with pizzicatos, but then support it with also harmonic pads and their own kind of expressivity. So it's two worlds that meet occasionally and then break apart again, then fuse. By the end of the piece, they're certainly fused. It's very sort of quite poignant conclusion to the piece. Andy Akiho is just a brilliant composer who's sort of having a extremely sort of fast-paced development on the musical scene right now, and I couldn't be happier for him. He's a first-rate writer.
Could you tell us where he's based?
Well, that's a great story, actually. and there's no way you could have known to ask me that, but it's a good question because he's actually based now in Portland, Oregon, and that's largely because of a percussion concerto that I commissioned from him via the Oregon Symphony Orchestra. And he started spending some time in Portland and, like anyone, just fell in love with it. I mean, it's just the most brilliant city, right? So he now is based there. I mean, he still has ties to other parts of the country, but he has a base in Portland and he's spending a lot of time there. And that's where he wrote the percussion concerto that I premiered with the Oregon Symphony a few weeks ago.
So you take a little bit of credit for...
for his current domicile? Yeah. I'm happy for him. I've seen it. He's doing all right. He's well set up. And then that's also where he finished writing Illuminus for us just a couple weeks ago.
I do like the name, Illuminus.
Yeah, it's very clever because it does... there's a sheen to the music. I don't know whether it's a cold or a warm... Maybe it's a bit of both, but there's a glow, gentle glow to the piece.
Are the bars on the vibraphone are metal? Are they aluminum?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, they are metal. I think there's some kind of alloy. Probably not aluminum.
Probably not. Yeah. It doesn't ring enough.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, but this piece rings very sweet and very true, and I think it'll get played a lot because other people can take it on and perform the work. It's going to be a bit of a smash hit. This one, I think.
What is your relationship to the metronome?
Very close. Never leave home without it.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even if I'm just going out to get eggs.
So what is it you've learned from using that device?
Yeah. Good question. First of all, that it's something that sets you free because it's...
So many people would disagree.
No, like, it's the ultimate freeing up device because... Once you've learnt, but it's the same with anything, I think, really, in the arts, or perhaps widely, the arts and sciences. Once you've learnt the rules, the constraints, once you've learnt where the time actually is, you know, without any kind of human elements or elements that might sway you one way or the other, once you've learnt that, then you've earned your stripes, and then you can turn it off. That's when you turn the metronome off. And then you allow yourself the ebb and flow that must occur in nearly all music, not all music. Sometimes you do want to be absolutely just immovable, right on the button. But other times you want to be on the button enough and not more. Or maybe you want to take a rather spectacular amount of liberty and pull the music one way and the other. But you have to earn it, I think. So at least for especially learning new music, it's very, very important to know where things actually start from and how precise, how they sound when they are played with that level of rhythmic precision. And then that's your liberty. But I have too many students come in and sort of playing, you know, very kind of all over the place. And you're thinking, well, have you tried this with a metronome to see where it's actually at? And nope, you know, the answer always comes no. And so then we work a little bit with the metronome, and then you realize the amount of freedom that is learnt from the knowledge of where you can come from in music. So it's totally, the metronome is the maximum liberator in music.
What a great response. I mean, a lot of us kind of dread the metronome test. You feel like, I've read this piece of music, I feel like I'm pretty solid, and then maybe I'll try it with a metronome, and they're like, oh no, I'm fast here, slow there.
It's fun, but I think a lot of the challenges for musicians.
People call it a prison, you know. People say it's like taking the music out of the music, but it's
no. It gives you the perspective. That reaction. I mean, I'm not overcritical of that because it can be frustrating, but that reaction is just it's too easy to have that kind of analysis of working with a metronome. It might feel constraining, but it's actually an enabling process. So to learn where things are at, just to give yourself the knowledge. Yeah, I mean, I'm repeating myself now. To give yourself the wherewithal to get past it, which is the goal, by the way. But you've got to learn where it's at, and that's interesting. So, yay metronomes!
Okay. I think we have just a few minutes left, and I want to hear the Steve Reich piece, the written for your group.
Is it the Mallet Quartet?
Mallet Quartet?
Yeah. So this was written for some other groups. Steve Reich is confusing, and I get confused myself genuinely, because Steve Reich wrote a piece for us called Quartet.
Ah.
But this is the Mallet Quartet, which was written for other ensembles slightly earlier in Steve's career. But we've taken it on and we play it a lot, and it's played by many, many student groups. And it's an absolutely gorgeous piece of music for two vibraphones and two marimbas.
Before we listen, I want to thank you, Colin, for keeping me here, keeping us together for this hour, and going behind the music for tonight with me. The concert starts at 7:30, and Jack Quartet, which is, as you said, a fabulous ensemble.
Absolutely wonderful group, yeah.
They're coming in as well. Music starts at 7:30 in the Dalton Center Recital Hall, and you can find full details at fontanamusic.org. And well, leave it there. Colin, the metronome will set you free.
Yes, it will. Better believe it.